Welcome to the Hamilton Spectator Newsroom Insider. I'm David Crosby. We're here with Molly Hayes this week to discuss the trial and sentencing of Sahab Jamshidi. Molly, to start us off, why don't you give us some of the background of Sahab's story?
So Sahab Jamshidi, he's a Hamilton man, a McMaster graduate, lives in Ancaster. He went down to St. Lucia in February 2015. He went to medical school there, so he had friends there. He already was kind of well entrenched in the community there. He was on vacation. He's an avid kite surfer, when he was charged in the drowning death of a little boy on the island. So a little bit of background on that case. Sahab was kite surfing at a beach on the south coast of St. Lucia. He says that he was out on the water kite surfing when he noticed this little boy out in the water drowning, and that he called for help and then helped launch a search party on the beach. Unfortunately, the boy drowned and his body washed up a couple days later. But the boy's family and church group, he was there with his grandmother at the beach that day for kind of like a picnic with their church. They said that Sahab had taken this kid out for a ride on his kiteboard, that he had snatched him from the beach, basically, that this babysitter that had been watching him had asked him not to, but that he took him out anyway without a life jacket and took him out for a ride where he fell off and drowned. So based on that, those reports, Sahab ended up being charged in this case back in February 2015. And so fast forward to now, 2 years later, the case just wrapped up this week in St. Lucia.
And how did that case wrap up?
So it kind of took an unexpected turn. So for close to 2 years, Sahab Jamshidi had maintained his innocence in this. He insisted he did not take this boy out, that he just spotted him in the water. But in January, the trial finally began. It had been delayed a couple times. It's kind of a slower justice system with some issues that it's kind of bottlenecked. But just 2 days into this trial, he actually pleaded guilty. And so then a couple weeks later, he was sentenced. And the way that it wrapped up was that he was ordered to pay 75,000 Eastern Caribbean dollars, which is basically like $36,000 here, to the family of this little boy, TJ Alibox. And once the payment was made, he's basically free to go back to Canada.
And did you get a sense at all of why he would have changed suddenly to a guilty plea?
It's tricky. I mean, I don't know. There's lots of reasons that people take guilty pleas. Sometimes it's because they're guilty. Sometimes it's a legal strategy. I obviously, as a journalist, it's not my job to figure out which of those two it was. But one of the interesting things I found from talking to some of the key players in this case and learning a little bit more about their system, it became clear that there might be reasons strategically to take this plea. I mean, one thing that stands out about the St. Lucian justice system is that majority rules. So in Canada, for a trial, there's 12 people on a jury, and for a verdict to stand, it must be unanimous. So all 12 of those people have to agree that someone is either guilty or not guilty. But there's 9 people on a jury and majority rules. So out of 9 people, if 5 decide you're guilty, then you're guilty.
Right.
So it's a risky thing. I mean, going to trial is always risky, but that is something that his lawyer pointed out to me as one of the things they had to consider. And another thing they had to consider was just the limited jury pool to begin with. So you're talking about an island with 200,000 people. That's not a lot of people to pick from. And on top of that, they don't vet jurors the same way that we would in Canada. So
how was the process different?
So here, for example, the Bosma trial, I covered that last year, and I covered the jury selection process. We don't normally cover that so in depth, but because this was a high profile case, I was there for every day of that. And in most cases, I mean, even if it's fairly limited, there are a couple questions that are asked. So, for example, you will ask if they have been victims of crime, or if they've been following the case in the media, or if they know anyone Those are basic questions to give you a sense of any potential bias.
True.
But in St. Lucia, all they know, I think, are their names, their occupation, and their religion, I think, as well as if they know any of the witnesses in the case. But other than that, you're kind of, as I think his lawyer put it, going in blind.
So how did you get involved with this?
So I have been covering this since early 2015. So it happened in February 2015, and I think just a couple days after Sahab was charged, I flew down. And at that time, the story for us was just about what the heck had happened here. I mean, it's a difficult thing to report on from Hamilton.
Absolutely.
So it was important to be there and meet the people involved, not only to get Sahab's side of the case, but also to get this family side. I think it's easy to forget that there's a little boy who died at the center of this case. And without being there, it was very difficult to reach his family and the people that loved him to do kind of the same tribute story that we would normally do in a case like this here. So that was part of it, was not just focusing on the Canadian guy in this case, but also remembering that there's a grieving family that's also really at the center of it.
So can you walk me through what that process would look like? I mean, from coming from Hamilton, getting off the plane in St. Lucia.
It's nerve-wracking. I mean, I was 2 years ago. I mean, I'm still fairly new, but I was definitely more new then. So it's a nerve-wracking. I mean, there's a lot of pressure when you're putting the money behind a reporter to go to another country, and there's expectations about delivering a good story. And I mean, in Hamilton, I know where the courthouse is. I know how to reach police. I know the phone numbers of all the basic agencies that I typically deal with for stories. But in St. Lucia, I mean, I was able to do a little bit of preparing ahead of time, but there wasn't a lot of notice. So it was really a case of, as soon as that plane landed, kind of hitting the ground running. So I relied a lot on, actually, on cab drivers. So I had a couple, who, I mean, it's a small island, you know. In a lot of cases, I would have only a first name of someone I was looking for and the general area of where they lived. And more than once, for example, Marceline Albert, the grandmother of TJ Alibox, yep, the little boy who died, I wanted to find her and talk to her about that day. So a cab driver took me to her neighborhood, and we got what we thought was kind of within a couple blocks, and the driver just asked a guy waiting for a bus if he knew Marceline, and the guy just hopped in the cab and took us right to her house. So there's a lot of kind of instances like that where you just rely on the people in the community and hope that somebody will be able to point you in the right direction.
So having been down once already, you went down just this past month for Jim Sheedy's expected sentencing.
Yeah, so that was another kind of interesting challenge. So I mentioned kind of briefly that it's a very bottlenecked justice system. So for example, there were several delays even getting the trial to happen in the first place. One of them last year in the summer, the courthouse shut down for months because of mold.
And had to move to a strip mall.
Yeah, they opened in this temporary location kind of off a highway. So it is a very delayed system, and there are lots of stops and starts. So we had arranged for me to go down to be there for the sentencing, which was supposed to happen on February 3rd. When I got there the day before, but when we arrived in court on the 3rd, we were all ready to go. I had planned that I would do all these interviews after the sentencing because people are always reluctant to talk before a matter is wrapped up. It's the same in Canada. So we really had planned for me to be there for the sentencing, but mostly afterwards. But in court that morning, it was put off for a week. It was put off until the 10th. So that was nerve-wracking. Like, what am I going to do?
I'm here. How do you justify going down there?
Yeah, I've been sent here, but this hasn't happened yet. They're very cagey for obvious reasons. They don't want to talk and risk any details about this getting out on either side before it does wrap up. So it was just a bit of a shifting of our goals there. You know, it was more about getting some color and some background and talking to people ahead of time instead of after the fact as we planned. So it had been delayed until the 10th, but when the 10th rolled around, it was delayed yet again, and it wasn't until the 23rd that it actually happened. So it's one of those things that, I mean, best laid plans, right? Yeah.
Was it a net positive at all, though? I mean, having the opportunity to get this color, this background, being able to talk to the family?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was interesting to be in the courtroom that day and just to be able to reflect some of those delays a little better. And it also, I mean, it's always beneficial to have that FaceTime with people, right? And getting to meet TJ's mom. I had not met her before. I'd only met the grandmother. And even just to check back in, it was interesting to see how their family situations have changed. It's been 2 years. So even just to see how kind of the families have evolved after this, it was interesting to see how much feuding there had been. There's a lot of finger pointing between the mom and the grandma and the dad. Everyone's kind of pointing at each other. And it was interesting to see that this court case is really kind of a sideshow to them, and that what happens to Sahab Jamshidi is kind of besides the point to them. They're all very fixated on kind of internally who's responsible for this boy's death. So, I mean, we didn't get the kind of legal drama story that I think we had expected, but it was still good to have kind of this human element that you can really only get there from, or get from being there.
Absolutely. Do you think that they're in any way satisfied with the outcome?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tricky thing, and they all kind of said it in similar things in different ways, but I mean, their kid died, you know, like there's nothing that's going to bring him back. And the compensation, I mean, the dad acknowledged, I think kind of sheepishly, that, I mean, he'll take it. There's a lot of poverty in St. Lucia. Work is precarious. He can use the money. So I think it's that is such a tiny thing in the grand scheme of things, but they were satisfied with what the judge came up with. And I think now it's clear that there's still a lot of just grief for them to work through. But
of course.
Yeah, it's. I think it's one of those things that how can you be satisfied?
And have you had a chance to talk to Mr. Jamshidi?
So I am told that he is going to be returning soon. I mean, that's as much information as I have. I think it was just a matter of paperwork and getting his passport and getting everything together. I mean, it's been 2 years. He's built a life there, in some aspects. I mean, it's kind of a life in purgatory, but it's still a life with belongings. And so, yeah, I'm not sure exactly when he's back, but I'm hoping once he does return that we can kind of sit down once again and kind of reflect on all of this.
Well, thank you for taking the time to sit down with me and reflect on all this.
Hey, thanks. Right, the tables have turned and I'm the one asking the questions now. So I have photographers Barry Gray and Gary Yokoyama here to talk a little bit about weather pictures. It's been a warm week and it's always interesting seeing the pictures they come up with to illustrate the weather. They've got to do it all the time, every season, and each time they have to find a way of making it a little bit different. So guys, tell us a little bit about how you find the perfect weather photo.
Well, weather is usually something assuming you go outside, it's something that we have to try to visually show that this affects my day, good or bad. It might be, if it's extreme weather, it could be, I'm going to have a hard time getting to work today, or it could be a nice day saying, maybe I don't want to go into work today.
And I think we look for, it's no mystery, we look for obvious visual things. If there's a big snowstorm, how can we illustrate that? So you'll look for somebody out shoveling or sweeping off their car. We'll go downtown to King and James a lot of times, and you'll look for people bundled up, you know, a tight shot of their face, bundled up against the snow. So I think we look for the same kinds of things that most people would visualize in their heads. It's not a mystery, I don't think.
What about when snow is not a factor? Because snow is such an obvious visual thing, but when it's just unusually warm, how do you show that? I mean, it would be great if someone was like in a bathing suit downtown, but when you can't find someone, like what do you look for?
Well, I guess the obvious things, you know, it's like people are out typically enjoying themselves in the weather. They could be in the park, they could be walking their dog, they could be throwing the frisbee, or they could just be just sitting on a park bench. But
to your point, it is a lot easier if it's warm enough that they are out for a run and they're not wearing a shirt or they're in shorts or whatever. You know, sometimes they'll say, "We'll go out. It's a nice day today." And it's nice, but it's not super nice. So people still have jackets on, and it's like, okay, well, that obvious thing is now gone. So now hopefully it's sunny and you can work something with sun and shadows in. So it just depends. It's just looking around and trying to identify the elements, and then you go to where the people are, and just hope for the best. And sometimes you go to some obvious places and the people aren't there, and then you go to other places. And
that's funny. Yeah. I'm sure, in terms of just as a job, it might be harder to capture the warm weather pictures, but it's probably more pleasant to be out looking for warm weather pictures than when we send you guys out in a blizzard to try and find other people in a blizzard.
Well, quite often, I mean, that's the thing. I always tell people that's the trade-off of the job. I mean, if it's a beautiful day, you're outside enjoying it. If the weather turns in the opposite direction, you're also out there hating it. But we're always out there trying to show you, in most cases, you have one photo to tell people, this is what your day was like or could have been like if you were outside.
Mm-hmm. And the irony of the bad weather day is there'll be days where we're having a virtual blizzard and the police are saying, you know, stay home, stay off the roads. And here it's like, get out there, get on the roads. And we go out and slide around in our cars and stuff. So it's kind of bizarre to think you're going the opposite way to the way they're telling everybody else to go.
And quite honestly, if it's a day where whether it's a snow day or everything is closed, for us, we can't say we're not going in. You still have to go in.
Especially have to go in.
Well, here's the thing. If I remember on certain, days where it was like a blizzard, we're still out there, and well, at least you can drive around and you can file remotely. You don't necessarily have to come into the office. So that's part. Technology allows you to do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Seems like a photographer capturing blizzard would be kind of a great weather photo. Just capture each other.
Quite often, I mean, if you're in a blizzard situation, as Barry was saying, that there are kind of traditional photos that you do. But quite honestly, if you're going through a winter where it was nonstop, and you'd be trying to look for, you're always trying to look for something different. Whenever mm-hmm. possible. And, you know, hopefully, you know, on that day where you're not finding anything, you just, hopefully, you know, you have a bit of luck.
There you go.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's just what it comes down to. It's luck, right? You're just, you can go places where you expect to see people and nobody's out. And, you know, so we continue looking.
Just have a camera at all times.
Yeah. Yeah, we just joke, we turn over rocks looking for pictures.
But make sure you get the rock's name.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Well, thanks for explaining that. It's always interesting looking at the pictures and just wondering where they came from.
Pleasure.
They hide in our heads and then they appear in the paper, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully on the front page.
Yeah.
You can only hope.
Yeah.
That does it for this week's podcast. Thanks for tuning in.